Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome your Studcast host of television and radio fame, Tony Basilio.
Ladies and gentlemen, whatever you do, please don't try this at home. Somebody could get hurt. It is your Studcast. It is 93 years. It is four generations. It is a story that must be told. It is a story that until now has not been told. It is a story involving the greatest storyteller in the business. And we are fresh off a happening that shook the world. What am I talking about? The Super Studcast. Super Studcast 1 dropped a few days back. Getting all kinds of comments on Twitter, on Facebook, in the email box. And Stud, I bet it's probably the same in your world, man. That and what David did at the beginning of that, just an absolute piece of art to be involved with that with you guys. Stud, welcome in.
Well, thank you very much. And yes, I'm glad you brought that up, Tony. I think it was just a remarkable opening for that first Super Stud cast. Dave did a fabulous job. It's very intricate, great work. I don't know that many programs are done with that type of effort put into it. Actually, it's got a great close on that program as well. So really proud of that Super Stud cast. It's just blowing up. Donations coming, people getting involved. They're going to listen to that first one. And it's out there now. And just like to let people know it's out there and available. All you got to do is go to Tennessee Stud. That's TNStud.com. Click on Super Stud cast. You can hook it up. Or you can go to Patreon.com/studcast and hook it up there. $2.99 donation, but they're going to get the Super Studcast, which people, the comments are just blowing up. They're just really, really great comments. I'm very, very pleased with the response that we are getting. And I just want to make people aware that you can go get this anytime you want it. It's going to be there for a long time. Once you make that first donation and get the Super Studcast, you're going to get on January 28th the rest of the Andre story, the question and answer 1 hour program, which it's a great one too. Tony, we're just really in uncharted water here. It's not been done like this before. We're just offering fans this 3 hours of extra content every month besides our regular Studcast, which are all free and always will be, these 3 extra hours. And it's just a nominal fee of $2.99. And you get both those programs, 3 hours of Andre. By the time people hear both of these, Tony, I believe they're going to say, I know more about Andre the Giant than most anybody does, because we lay out a whole lot of information in these two broadcasts in January. So just very, very pleased with it. Happy to be back. Always happy to be here. Great to get back in that saddle again today. And Tony, I want to just bust right into it, if that's all right with you. Just move straight ahead.
Oh, absolutely. Go for it, my man. It's 1967. We're still down in beautiful Atlanta. Two of my favorite passions, a little bit of hoops and a little bit of wrestling today, Suz. So without further ado, my man, it's all you.
All right. What I'm going to do is I'm going to harken back to about 3 or 4 programs ago in which I talked a little bit of basketball. I mentioned the coach that I had my junior year. His name was Chris Jones, a great coach. What a great team we had as a junior. Now I'm a senior. My parents have moved from Griffin, Georgia, where we lived and where the school where I was attending and playing basketball. They've moved into Atlanta. And the school there is called Briarcliff. Now my brother lives in Atlanta, and my old coach there in Griffin recruited me. He finds me a home to live in, and he says, Ron, I want you to stay here through the basketball season. And he found me a house with these two great older people, nice home. They cook me breakfast in the morning. I stay there from Monday morning, go to school, spend the nights there on Friday. My mom comes and picks me up out of Atlanta. She takes me back to Atlanta, and I spend the weekends in Atlanta. Well, when I get to Atlanta every weekend, I've got the coach there, the high school coach at Briarcliff. He's a guy named Ray Hambrick, and he finds out that I live there, and he's crazy for me to come and play at Briarcliff. So I've got a decision to make here within the first couple of months of that school year. I stay down there in Griffin. Coach Jones treats me great. He takes me and shoots with me at night, just keeps me occupied as much as he can. He knows that we have opportunity to win the state championship. We had a great team as juniors. A lot of them come back as seniors. He's sitting on a state championship team, but I'm beginning to feel like all young guys, especially when you go to college in your first year, I find that out in the next year, that it gets more difficult for you. And when you're a high school senior and you can't live with your parents and you're living in one city and commuting on the weekends and staying home 2 days a week and 5 days in another city, it's not a good situation. So before the season starts, about 3 weeks prior to the season starting, I leave Griffin and I go to Briarcliff. Every Saturday for a month prior to that, the Briarcliff coach has me going and practicing with his team. So I'm spending 5 days a week practicing with the Griffin, Georgia High School basketball team. And then I spend every weekend, Saturdays, sometimes even on Sundays, playing with the guys from Briarcliff and the school in Atlanta. So I make the move. I go to Atlanta. Now, this is a good school that I'm in. It's a big school. It's much bigger than Griffin. It's one of the highest classifications in the state. I think there's more than 5,000 students there, certainly a graduating class of well over 1,000. So it's a big school. They have never had success with basketball in the history of this school. School opened up in 1958. It's going to stay there as an entity until the early 2000s, I believe, and then they tear that school down. But in the entire time, from the time I came there and joined that team, we have not only the best basketball team that that school ever had, but we in that senior year of mine are going to have the best team, period, that that school has ever had. The largest winning percentage, the best athletic team they ever produced. We're going to go to the state tournament. Lots of things are going to happen great for Ray Hambrick and the guys in Briarcliff that I went to play for. It's a great opportunity for me. I love living in Atlanta. It gives me an opportunity to play against even better schools than probably I did living in Griffin, which is a small town 30 miles or so south of Atlanta. So we have got on that team, I notice we've talked about this. I think we talked about it about 4 weeks ago when we talked a little basketball. They have not integrated schools in Georgia at this point. It's 1966. This is the last season, 66-67, that they will have unintegrated schools in the state. They're going to integrate schools. We're all going to play. No matter what color you are, you're all going to play together, which is a wonderful thing. But this season, it's going to be played with one race against the same race and the other against themselves. It's different in a bad situation. It's a wonderful thing to have that all a thing of the past. But I just want the listeners out there to understand that we're playing with white people, white guys against white guys, and blacks against blacks. So there's not, you know, a lot of black guys have tremendous skills in athletics. They're made for it. So I'm on a team here now that has 8 guys that can dunk out of 10 players. 8 of them are capable of dunking. It's pretty amazing to have that happen in high school level. I remember that when we went and played a lot of games, we start our season, we're 10-0. We're undefeated for the first 10 games of the season. We're having people to just go crazy. What we do is we have two guards that can't dunk. They just stay underneath the basket. And during warmups, we start coming in and dunking. We put it 10 guys, 8 guys in a row, take off their jackets, their warm-up jackets, and they start dunking. And we dunk 8 in a row. I'm the last one in. I'd give it the 2 hands behind their back. You know, we've got a tremendous high school team here. We've got a lot of talent on this team. We've got jumpers and leapers on this team. We've got physical bodies on this team. This team is going to go places. I have no idea how far exactly it is going to go, but it's going to be the best team in Atlanta and one of the best teams in the entire state. We have a tournament there. Every year, this team plays in a tournament called La Crosse Keys Christmas Tournament. It's a tradition in Atlanta. A lot of the big Atlanta schools are invited. You have to play by invitation. They invite us this year to play in that Cross Keys Invitational Tournament. And that is the biggest holiday season event that goes on in high school basketball in Atlanta. The Atlanta Journal, the Atlanta Constitution, the paper there, they cover high school sports pretty darn well. So we're in this tournament. It's a 3-night tournament. And by the 3rd night, we make it to the finals. So we're into the finals. And my dad takes me the day we're playing in the finals. He gets me up in the morning and he says, "Hey, boy, how about we go down to that farm I've got in Locust Grove and we work a little bit today?" I say, "Well, you know, Dad, I've got a championship game here tonight in Cross Keys and I really don't want to get too tired today. I don't want to do, we'll just go down there and mess around." So he talks me into going there. Now, I may have explained a couple weeks back, Dad was not really into basketball. He didn't want me to play basketball. And now this is a situation to where he's got me in his car. We drive 40 miles south out of Atlanta, and we get out there, and I say, "What do you want to do?" And he says, "I want to cut wood, you know, with axes." So I got an axe. He's got an axe. I've been through this with him many times. We start cutting wood about 11 o'clock in the morning, and we cut wood till 5 o'clock in the afternoon. About 3 o'clock, I start saying, "You know, Dad, I really need to go. You know, I need to get back home, and I've got to catch the bus. They're going to all take all of us, the whole team, over to the gym where we're playing, and I need to get out of here." And he just would hem and haw, and, let's stay a little bit longer, just a little bit longer. So he finally keeps me there till we're so late that by the time I get home, I take a quick shower. I'm pretty worn out by then. I'm getting tired. I've been working pretty much all day, chopping wood, pretty tough job. He takes me over to the bus. Now, the bus is gone. So, in other words, the team figures I'm not going to play tonight. So, they've gone, they've left, and they figure that, you know, I'm just not coming. So, now I'm upset with him, and I say, "You know, you really got to take, well, you know, if you miss this game, it's just one game." I said, no, it's not just one game. It's a championship game in the biggest Christmas tournament in the city, and I want to play tonight." So, he finds out how to get us to Cross Keys. I show up there about 20 minutes before game time, go out to play in the game. Have a great game. He goes up and sits in the stands. It's one of the first games, my high school games, that he ever watched. I have a great game at night. I have 22 points and 22 rebounds, I think it is. I win the MVP of the tournament. We win the tournament. I get the MVP award. I go back home. He carries me home. I don't ride home on the bus. He carries me home. And the next day, I get up in the morning and I go get the paper because I'm thinking there's maybe a story in there. I get the paper. We're sitting, me, him, and Rob, my mom, at the breakfast table. And I whip open the sports. I peel back about 6 pages to the high school page. And, geez, there I am, big picture, man. And then, but the headline says, "Wrestler's son leads Briarcliff victory." So it's like, what happened is he went up, sat down in the stands. He happens to sit next to the reporter from the Atlantic Journal that wrote the story. And the story's written basically about his wrestling exploits and a little bit about my basketball skills. So it's like my dad messes me around, almost causes me to miss the game entirely. And then puts me in a position to where I don't get the headlines. He gets the headlines. So it's kind of like being the wrestler's son. It's the old story, you know, you're second fiddle, man. And I was kind of second fiddle.
Well, and with your dad, it's always been, it's complicated, you know. Not much normal about your dad. And really not much normal about the relationship you guys had, huh, Stud?
No, I mean, you know, Dad was a pretty unique individual, and he does things in a different way. I assume that day he had an intention of me not making it at all. I think he felt a little guilty, so he did run me over there. And thank goodness I had a good game. Thank goodness we won the tournament. It all seemed to work out all right. Even the story in the Atlanta Journal turned out to be good. Good for him, good for me as well. It was a great place to play basketball. They had never drawn sellout crowd in their gym. They had a big gym. I asked the coach there early on, I said, "Do they sell this gym out?" And he goes, "No, we've usually put half the people, fill half the seats." Well, by the time we get to the 10th game of the season and we're 10-0, we're selling out this 4,000 seat gym. And not only are we selling out the seats and the stage, they put chairs on the stage. At one end of the gym, upstairs, they have a great wrestling team there. 5 years straight state champion wrestling team. They train up there. So they put fans up there in that top part. They pack as many bodies into that school gym as they possibly could. And then they pack it like that for the rest of the season. Every game we play, you can't get all the people in there. Lots of them are standing outside. It becomes the place to be. Really, really. We turned that thing around entirely for basketball. They had never been known for basketball. And that team, that 1966-67 team at Briarcliff, like I said, is the all-time winningest team of any kind they ever had in the school. And that record remains to this day. I'm pretty proud of that. I didn't realize some of that until I got to doing your thing. I got to Googling a little bit, and I wanted to see if they had any info on those old schools. And I found a lot of stuff. There's a lot of great stuff. It shows our team itself, the photo with the Cross Keys Championship Tournament in the middle of it. It was a great privilege and a great honor to be in Atlanta. And by being in Atlanta, I was getting so much more publicity than I would have been had I been living in Griffin or one of the outlying regions. So I was becoming a big star. I was becoming a name basketball player in high school in Georgia, 1966 and 1967. I'm going to switch it a little bit here, and let's go to a little bit of wrestling. I mentioned that they have a wrestling team there. They have a great wrestling team there. Rob goes out for the wrestling team and makes the team. He's a sophomore, and to get on that team, you got to be a pretty darn good wrestler. Now, Rob doesn't have much of an amateur background. He has a shooting background. In amateur and wrestling, in the amateurs at the high school level and the college level, you can't shoot. You can't get a hold that's going to make someone give up or hurt them. You're really limited as to what you do. And those limitations really made it difficult for Rob because he had that training in one direction, but now he's got to back off from his training and try to figure out how to do these things without hurting somebody. And it makes it difficult for him. So he's on the team. There happens to be a wrestler that comes into Georgia at that time. This is phenomenal. And I Googled this to find this myself because his name was Dale Lewis. Dale Lewis is a monumental story in himself. Dale Lewis wrestled in the 1956 and 1960 Olympic teams. He had trained. He had never wrestled in his life. I Googled him, and I find out that he has never had any wrestling training. He starts training for wrestling, learning to be a wrestler, and in 6 months, he makes the Olympic team. He is so suited for the sport that he just is phenomenal from the very beginning. It's just unheard of for someone to be able to amass those type of skills. So he goes to Oklahoma. Oklahoma University is big time wrestling. I mean, that's amateur wrestling heaven out there. You got your Jack Briscoes and you got your Bill Watts and you got a lot of wrestlers that came out. You got Danny Hodge. I mean, you've got all those names that came out of that college and that program. And so Dale Lewis goes there with 6 months of wrestling training and wrestling background, makes that team. And not only makes the team, he's competing. His biggest competitor, and I couldn't believe this in reading the Google thing, is his biggest competitor in competition was Bill Watts. Bill Watts is playing on the football team, and Dale Lewis is on the wrestling team. Watts, he's on the wrestling team as well. He wants to make that wrestling team, and he could never take it past Dale Lewis. Dale Lewis kept getting the championships. He won 2 national championships while he was there. He went to 56 Olympics and the 1960 Olympics. So Dale Lewis is wrestling in Georgia. He happens to be wrestling in Atlanta at the time. And Dad really takes a liking to Dale Lewis because he's legit, for one thing. I mean, the guy's really, and he's big. He's about 6'4", about 290 now. He's a monster of a guy. He's a Greco-Roman wrestler. Now, there's a difference between the all-out type of wrestling that you do in the amateurs, in which you get on the mat and on your hands and knees. Greco-Roman is basically takedowns. It's just taking guys off their feet, and you get points for taking them down. So his skills are limited as far as really wrestling, and as far as shooting, he knows nothing about shooting, but he's got this amateur background, Greco-Roman, fabulous on his feet. So Dad talks him into going to Briarcliff High School and just sitting out there, just taking a look at the boys, introduced them. He spoke to everybody. Rob tells me about that day. He says, you know, Dale Lewis was unbelievable. He said everybody had so much respect for him. He said you could hear a pin drop. When he started to talk, everybody got quiet. So Dale individually works with some of those wrestlers, some of those high school wrestlers. Now, this isn't an average high school wrestling team. This is a wrestling team who has already won 5 state championships in a row. They are a great team. Now they're getting the benefit of some training from a guy like Dale Lewis, which you can't get much better training than that. And so Rob says it was a great day for all those kids. They were extremely, extremely pleased, and they were blown away by how strong he was, for one thing, how big he was, and the skills he had on his feet. So that's one of the examples of Dad's, the way he focused and took care of business and how he utilized guys in a great way that made them better individuals. And it certainly made a great impact on that high school wrestling team.
When people knew who you guys were, and it comes to high school wrestling, do they try you? Do they say, oh, your dad's into that fake stuff? Do they? What's that like for you at that age?
Well, at that age, it's still got that same concept. We talked about it many, many studcasts back when I was a kid and in the 3rd, 4th grade. People started putting me together with Buddy Fuller and saying, hey, you're his son, and can you wrestle, and are you tough? And so you have to start. That's when Dad started teaching me a few little shooting moves that were absolute killer shooting moves that didn't take you long for people to have respect for you, and they didn't want to test you anymore. But that happened my entire lifetime. Rob's too. We've dealt with that to where it was usually not our age group. Our age group, we were comparable size. It was guys that were 4, 5, 6 grades ahead of you that wanted to try you because they're a lot bigger and, you know, they weren't scared. So you really learn to take care of yourself. Basketball season and wrestling season are at the same time of the year. I could not wrestle and play basketball because it was hard enough just to deal with the practices that you had for basketball, much less you throw in those tough practices that you have for wrestling. It's like football players can wrestle because football season ends and wrestling's beginning. But basketball and wrestling pretty much coincide, and it makes for a real problem there. So Rob was the wrestler, and I was the basketball player. I've never got very many people at that point that were giving me any grief about wrestling me. I was 6'7 by then, maybe even close to 6'8, and I was a little over 200 pounds, still very thin, but that height really stops a lot of people from wanting to jump on your butt, because when they start looking up at you, they start having a different thought process about, you know, taking care of you or trying to compete with you. So it was pretty easy for me. I didn't really have to do anything much. I'm sure Rob dealt with quite a bit of it because he was on the wrestling team. Obviously, those guys on the team, they're good. They're a lot better at the wrestling at that stage than Rob is because they've got a lot more experience.
Yeah, and I was a high school wrestler myself, and there's nothing like that. When you go in and there's a deficit of experience and somebody has the ability to turn you up and twist you around and all that, obviously you guys and what you were disciplined in and the stuff, the shooting your dad was teaching you from an early age is one thing, but that high school stuff is totally another. That's got to be like a foreign world to you as you learn to do that.
Oh, yeah. It definitely is. And you're so behind the eight ball. If you don't have that training, you know from having been a wrestler that it's technique. It's all technique. It's, you know, and it's leverage. It's knowing what to do and how to do it. And if you've got those skills and you can go places as an amateur wrestler and you did develop those skills, I developed those skills. We were lucky enough to come from a wrestling family. So we wrestled a lot. We did sit outs and we did the basic amateur moves, obviously. But then we just added the killer moves and those submission holds that the training that we had with the basic training. And it made for us to be better wrestlers because we had a little of both. I didn't get as much of that amateur background as Rob did, but I probably got a little more of the shooting background because I'm going to, within a couple of years, start to experience the snake pit. And when you get in that snake pit in Florida, then you are in the middle of the real daddy there. They don't make it any worse than being in that snake pit.
Anytime you mention the snake pit, we get comments, emails. Everybody's so infatuated with the snake pit. And the snake pit to me sounds like every time you've mentioned it, all I think about is just total pain and then some place that's somewhere on the boulevard of broken dreams, stud. But when we really get into that snake pit, you really unpack some of the stuff that really went on there. Because I know you've told me we could do a couple shows on the snake pit down the line once we get there.
Yes, you know, and we're in chronological order here, and I'm trying my best to stay there. I want to jump here, and I want to jump there. When we have some questions, they take us some different directions, but I may have four episodes on the snake pit. The snake pit, it was a dynamite experience for me. I couldn't believe that so few guys took advantage of that opportunity. They had those guys coming in there like Matsuda and Roop and Jack Briscoe and Don Curtis, and just great talents, great wrestlers, great shooters. And I was the young guy that was in there. I mean, there were other guys there. Rob was there, and Jimmy was there, and Dick Slater was there, and Mike Graham was there, but nobody came. It was just me coming down there with these guys. I was the only one willing to experience that, hoping to get tougher and be able to handle what was probably lying ahead for me as a professional wrestler. So, you know, it was a phenomenal place to be, and there wasn't very many snake pits in the wrestling world, that's for sure.
No, but a lot of snakes.
Yeah.
A lot of snakes, my man, a lot of snakes.
Oh, hell yeah. And I got bit by a few of those suckers, too. You know, I mean, a lot of snakes and a lot of crazy, crazy people. Wrestlers are just as wild as any individual. I think professional wrestlers, to me, they are the cowboys of the 20th century. They are, you know, cowboys went out after they started building the fences and changed everything for those guys. But those were individuals and hard workers and just beat themselves to pieces and handled those rough damn cattle and all the things that they did. And when it came to the 20th century, you know, my feeling is that professional wrestlers became the cowboys of the 20th century because they worked independently. They got themselves hurt all the time. They dealt with so much a different lifestyle than everybody else. And cowboying, I've done a little bit of that. I've done some roping and I've done some riding. I've ridden broncs. I've been on a bull. I mean, I've tried a little bit of all that. And that's a darn tough living there, too. So it can be very, very difficult to manage to make it as a cowboy. Yeah, you got to be a tough individual to even want to do it. And it's the same thing with a wrestler. You've got to be really cut from some kind of strange cloth to want to put those tights on. So we normally take a break, but I say let's load them up with content here,
you
man.
Got it.
I want to just roll on here. I want to finish my high school season, and I think we have a couple questions at the end today. We'll get to those. But I want to go back. Now, we're 10-0, and I think we lose our first game, 12 games in or whatever. We end up at the end of the season, we end up at 20-2 at the end of the regular season. We're in the state tournament. We've played to get into the state. We've won the region. We're in the state tournament. Something happens, though, on the weekend prior to the state tournament that I have to apologize to all those players and to that coach. He tells us we make the state tournament. I think that's on a Friday night. We finish the region championship on a Friday night, and we've got a week to prepare for the state championship tournament. And he takes us aside and he says, I don't want you guys to do anything, play any basketball anywhere this coming week. I just want you to stay home, stay off your feet, rest, make sure you don't get hurt. You know, and I listen like everybody else. I think I'm paying attention. But there was another guy on that team I really liked, a guy named Bob Duncan. We were personal friends. We used to go and play at these little gyms here and there and pick up games, that type of thing. We just like to play. So we sit for a couple of days, and on a Sunday, we decide we're going to go to one of those little pickup gyms and play. And during one of those games, I break my ankle. Now we're 4 days away from the state tournament opening game, and I've broken my ankle. And I go home. It swells up huge, obviously. I don't want to go and get anything done with it because I'm afraid. I want to play in the state tournament. I want us to win the state. I thought we had an excellent chance to do that. So I go finally on Monday morning, and they do x-rays, and they confirm that I have a hairline fracture. So, you know, they tell you we're going to put the cast on. So I talk them out of it. I say, no. I want to play ball. I think I can play in the state tournament hurt if I can just get to the therapy and get into my gym and get in the hot tub and do whatever the coach thinks it is. So I go early in the morning on that Monday, find out I've got a broken ankle. I go back home. My coach finds out that I'm not there, and he comes to my house, and he calls me outside, and I have to go out on crutches. And I don't think I've ever seen a worse look on a guy's face than that day when he looked up and saw me coming out the back door on crutches. You know, and I felt horrible. So he takes me to school. This is on a Monday, and we start with a program to try to get my swelling down enough. I tell him I want to play. I don't care what I have to do. I want to play. So we start doing 20 minutes hot tub, 20 minutes ice. We alternate that back and forth all day through Monday. Tuesday, he picks me up at home. We do it Tuesday. We do it Wednesday. We do it Thursday. Friday is the opening round of the state tournament. I go to the gym. I didn't talk to him about this, but my swelling is down. My ankle is, I can't put any weight on it hardly at all. So I'm wondering now, can I do this? How in the world am I going to be able to do this? And we play at the Georgia Tech University's gymnasium. It sits right there by Interstate 75 across from the old Varsity Drive-In. It was there for many years. I don't know if that gym is still there. A round, beautiful gym. They play a state tournament in there. I go into the dressing room, and he has a doctor come. And the doctor comes and brings Novocaine. So this is high school. Yeah, I'm sure this is illegal as it can possibly be. But I've been all week trying to get prepared. I tell him, I'll do anything you want. And he comes and he says, Ron, I got a way that you may be able to do it. You may be able to survive this. And when he does that, I sit up on a table. The doctor comes in. Now, the guys on the team, they all came and filled the doorway. They're going to watch him give me these Novocaine shots and a broken ankle. And that process starts. They watch two or three or four, and I watch the door over there, and I see them start to dwindle away. They're like heads down. They're like wiping their forehead, like they're sweating like I am because I'm getting the shots. It was unreal for them to stand there and watch what I was going through to be able to put my shoes on and go out there and play that game in the state tournament.
And that's some classic stuff right there, because now we have these tents, you know, on these sidelines, these football games where they take you back in the locker room or whatever it is they do. I mean, back then, imagine giving a kid a Novocaine shot back in 1967, Stud. Just think about how crazy that is, man.
It's absolutely ridiculously crazy. And, you know, I know it was illegal as it could possibly be, and there would have been all kinds of outcries about it. But I'll tell you what, he gave me those shots, and within 20 minutes, I put on a shoe, and I can stand up. And I was like, wow. It's pretty amazing, you know. And then he says, I got something else. So he comes with a black blow-up boot, and he puts that boot on my foot, and there's a hose connection to it, and he pumps up the air into that boot, and it fills that shoe to where my shoe is twice the size of my other foot. Now, when he gives me that support, I've got these shots now that are beginning to take effect. I go out on the floor, and I'm dunking during the warm-ups. I'm actually out there being dumb enough to dunk prior to the game starting. You know, I'm ready to play. So we play a team called Butler, the best team in the state. Okay, they're undefeated. We've lost two games in the course of the season. It's first round of the tournament. We play them. I've got this broken ankle. I don't tell anybody. Nobody knows. I don't think anybody on the floor could tell that I had a broken ankle. And during the course of that game, I got 16 points and 21 rebounds with a broken ankle. And we end up going into overtime, tied at the end of regulation. We go into overtime, and we lose by 2 points to Butler in overtime. And they go on 2 nights later to win the state championship. Even with a broken ankle, I got us to within 2 points in overtime of potentially maybe being able to win the state championship. So what they do back in those days in 1966, 67, if you make the state tournament team, you are All-State. They didn't select All-State basketball players back in those days. So I made that state tournament team. People didn't know I played that game with a broken ankle. Maybe they did. I don't know how many people knew about it. Maybe some people knew. But I was selected to the All-State team, which meant I ended up being an All-State basketball player my high school year in Georgia, which was a great feat. You know, I was always proud of that honor. It was a good thing. During the course of that season, the season ended, and they got down to the times when you have your banquets, and they bring everybody out, and they talk to you, and they introduce you, and they give you awards and whatever. I found out in the 24 games that we played, period, I had 497 rebounds in 24 games. Which is, it's an average of 20 rebounds per game, which that, I guess, by anybody's standards, even today's day and time, 20 rebounds a game is a pretty good number. I was not as good a scorer, probably, as a rebounder, but I had great skills as a rebounder. I was getting stronger, and I had an attitude that I assumed I probably got from being around my dad and being around wrestlers that helped me considerably to be a great rebounder. I won the MVP for the team, and then at the end of the year, I got a real honor, and Rob talks to me about this. He says they had an awards banquet at the last day of school, and they fill up the gymnasium with all the students in the school. It's so full, the gym, that I got there late, and I couldn't get inside the gym. So I'm standing in the hallway looking through the door to watch what goes on. They give all kinds of awards during the course of this award thing here at the end of this season. And there's a trophy sitting up there on the stage that's like 3 times bigger than anything else. And I see that trophy and I'm wondering, what's that one all about? And so they go through all the awards. They get down to the end, and the last award they gave away, there was just that big trophy left. And my coach, they said, now we're going to give the award to the best athlete in Briarcliff. So, you know, I was like, I didn't even consider me being the guy to get it. I'd only been there for 10 months. I didn't even go for an entire year. Came in there 2 months into the season before I even enrolled in that school. And so my basketball coach goes up there and he makes the announcement. And he called me Tiny. Rob said he sat up there. He remembers sitting up there with the sophomores. And they said, now we got the last award for the best athlete in the school. And they said, Tiny Welch. And Rob looked at, he said, all the boys went, God, that's your brother, man. Your brother's won the dang big trophy. So it was a great honor. It was a wonderful experience. My high school days were fabulous. I look back on them. I'm really pleased with some of the decisions I made. I get recruited a lot, obviously, a lot of letters. I'm recruited by a bunch of schools. Finally, I peel it down to LSU, Tennessee, Oregon State, and Clemson. And I end up signing in 66 with Clemson, and I start my college career from there. That kind of covers basketball.
Exciting stuff, Stud. As you know, we've got about 15 or so minutes left, and doesn't matter what story you're telling, Stud, as long as you're talking, I'm listening, and that's all I know. It's always interesting. But our Super Studcast that just dropped a few days ago, as folks are listening to this for the first time, and no matter when you're hearing this, it's always going to matter because our Super Studcast is always going to be there. It's always going to be available to you. But our Super Studcast just dropped, and here we are. We are in show 28 today. I've got a couple questions here that our listeners have sent in and supporters of the Studcast that deal with Andre the Giant. And, you know, a lot of that Andre stuff now is behind the paywall. And the Super Studcast extra program is going to be back there as well, Stud. But I thought it'd be good if we got a few questions on today for everybody to hear you perhaps talk about Andre a little bit. Would you mind if we did that, Stud?
No, it's a great idea, Tony, because I know that a couple of days ago that program dropped and I did what I said I was going to do. I went on Facebook. I asked for people that if they had questions that we were going to do this rest of the Andre story program. And gosh, it was unbelievable. They went on that Facebook, my page, and we just were inundated. We could have done 5 question and answer shows. So, you know, this is great. We're going to give those people, obviously, on January the 28th, on Sunday, January 28th, a couple weeks from now, they're going to hear the rest of the story, and they will get these questions. But I think it's a great idea. We got overflow questions. This is a great way to get those people that sent their questions that aren't going to be recognized in the rest of the Andre story question and answer podcast, but they're going to get some recognition here in number 28's podcast. I think it's great, Tony.
So let's go ahead and we'll start with David Carmichael, Johnson City, Tennessee. Wants to know rather succinctly, Stud, did you ever tag with Andre as part of a tag team?
Great question. You know, there's a short answer and there's a long answer. And, you know, I'll start with the short one, but I'm going to give you the long one too. Yes, one time I tagged with Andre. And it was an unusual circumstance. This was when Southeastern Wrestling in Pensacola, the Southern Division of Southeastern Wrestling, the tag team champions were Arn Anderson and Jerry Stubbs. Gosh almighty, those boys were a great tag team. I mean, those guys are great workers and great, great talents in the ring. And they had hurt Rob bad enough that Rob couldn't participate. He was out for a couple of months. They hurt Jimmy because they were trying to eliminate competition. I think they were just really trying to work through everybody there. Back in those days, it was before Bob Armstrong turned on me in the Ric Flair match, and they were dealing with the Armstrongs. They were working their way through bodies, and they were leaving a lot of good wrestlers sidelined because they were kicking butt. And so I wanted, because of what had happened with Robin, with Jimmy, I wanted to take the belts from these guys. I mean, I wasn't even considering, I wasn't interested in being the singles champion. I wanted to find a partner that could take it to their butts and beat them. So I had several different people come in that were friends of mine. They couldn't get it done. We, for whatever reason, didn't get it done. And I remember the day going on television and saying, I've got myself a best partner in the world. And they came out, I think, and cut an interview while I was in the back about, we don't care who it is or how big and how bad he is, the whole deal. And then I remember going out. Andre wasn't there, but then I remember going out and saying, my man is Andre the Giant. Then they came back out. It's almost the program's over, just screaming, you can't do that. You can't bring that guy here as your partner. So Andre and I wrestled Arn Anderson and Jerry Stubbs, and we actually wrestled them twice. We did not win the championship. We did not beat them either time. They lost by disqualification, and both times they lost by disqualification on purpose because you couldn't win the championship on a disqualification. So we would have beaten them undoubtedly, but that's a great question. You know, that pushed me to the absolute limit, and it was a phenomenal match that we had with them. Those guys were really good at that point. They even gave Andre some tough deals. I think they double slammed Andre. I'd never seen anybody do that to him before. Those guys were great. And it's a testament to the talent that was wrestling back in those days in that Southeastern Southern Division. They were killer, killer athletes. And so answer to the question is, yes, two matches. Andre was my partner twice. Sorry to say we did not win those championships. However, just the rest of the story here real quickly is 2 weeks later, Bob Armstrong comes back, and then Bob and I reunite. We do beat those suckers. We did get the win over Stubbs and Anderson.
Robert Collier wants to know, and he's from Santa Rosa, California. How many matches did you work with Andre? So I guess we talked about you working as a tag with him. What about as an opponent or going against Andre?
I never wrestled Andre in a singles match. I had many, many occasions. And if I were to try to think here, I'm going to say it probably at least 10 times I was involved with Andre in battle royals. And one of the stories I tell in this Super Stud cast is involving my first altercation and my first time in a battle royal. I was in many battle royals with Andre. Gosh, being in the ring with Andre is an experience because when he touches you, you don't know what to expect from him. You don't know his strength. You don't know what that immense size and what that weight, how difficult it is to move him and to think about being able to throw him individually over the top rope. It's unbelievable. But I have seen Andre wrestle some single matches. I watched him wrestle Ronnie Garvin in Knoxville, Tennessee, in the Southeastern Wrestling in the Northern Division, and one of the greatest wrestling matches I ever saw. I saw somewhere the other day that it may be that Ronnie Garvin beat Andre. Now, I don't remember that, and I watched that match. I was amazed at how well Ronnie Garvin did against the Giant. But I don't remember him beating him. That, to me, is a feat for any one man to beat him. And, you know, Hogan slams him later on. There's a lot of good stories about Hogan and Andre, as a matter of fact. At some point, we may get to that. But that's a great question, too. Had a lot of times in the ring with Andre, a couple times as a partner, and several times in battle royals. Never had a singles match with him.
The one thing I got, Stud, from the Super Studcast, and you kind of get from you talking about him here, is the respect that you have for Andre the Giant. That shines through every time you talk about him. And then also, there was, for most people who worked with him, there was a little bit of a fear factor with Andre, because let's face it, he was big enough to hurt whomever he wanted, whenever he wanted, basically wherever he wanted, especially a young Andre the Giant.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and you felt that. I mean, you didn't crawl into that ring. He's standing in that ring, and you go crawling through the ropes in there with him. You got to think, man, wow, if this son of a gun wants to hurt me, he's going to be able to do pretty much anything he wants to me, and that's a bad darn deal. I'd like to just plug a little bit of next week. We're going back to wrestling, and I got an unusual one for next week. Tony, Dad's a different type of dude, and he forms a relationship with a personality in Atlanta who is going to become a monster in the entire United States of America. He's a guy that owns billboard companies, and he owns television stations, and he owns it all, and he happens to be a tremendous wrestling fan. He's a huge wrestling fan. He loves the numbers that the sport produces on WHBQ in Atlanta. And we're going to talk next week about my father's relationship with Ted Turner. I think people will be amazed at what Dad was offered by Ted Turner at one time in his life. And just to know a person like that is pretty darn spectacular. So next week, we're going to roll back to wrestling, and we're going to cover a lot of ground, and some of it is going to do with one of probably the better-known people in the world, and Ted Turner. We got another minute or so here.
Go for it. Yeah, man. Go for it.
Yeah. I want to thank the hundreds and hundreds of fans who have already gone and donated to hear the Super Studcast with Andre. They're going to obviously get a second one here on January 28th. They're not going to pay anything more for that. They're going to get that as free package, part of the package. It's just phenomenal, I think, what the comments. I love the comments because I love knowing how people think about what you're doing and are you making them happy or not. And I've always had phenomenal comments, but the comments that are coming off of that Super Studcast is just really, it brightens me. It makes me feel good. And I know that it's there. Everybody can go and get it. If you want to go and get it at any time, it's there now. It's in two places. You can get it off the website at Tennessee Stud. That's TNSTUD.com. You go there. You click on Super Studcast, and you can do your thing there, get that set up to start getting it. Or you can go to Patreon. That is patreon.com/studcast. And as soon as you get to that site, you'll see the Super Studcast, and you can make contributions to other things if you want while you're there, but it's where you pick up that Super Studcast. I encourage people to listen to this broadcast. I think it's some of the best stuff I've ever done while I've been in this, and I'm about 6 months in at this point. And I also want them to know that on January 28th is coming that question and answer program in which all these fans wrote in their questions. We'll do that program when we do. I think that'll be a wonderful program, too. I love answering fans' questions. That'll be a great one. And I want to talk just a second about the next Super Studcast, which comes in February, on Sunday, February 11th. And it is going to have to do with, I call it third world countries. It's going to have to do with Caribbean, basically. We're going to talk about being an athlete and being a professional wrestler, especially in the dangerous areas of the world, in the areas in which your rings are unknown, your fans are unknown. Everything is a little bit scary, and that's the Bahamas, and it's Puerto Rico, the Cayman Islands. We're going to talk about all types of things. Some of the absolute funniest stories that I have to do with the Bahamas. And I can't wait to tell those stories because I've told them to different people in little social meetings and gatherings with a small amount of people. And people just go crazy. They go, wow, it's the best stories I've ever heard. And I've saved this for a studcast. And that's what we're going to do on February 11th, Sunday the 11th. The second studcast is going to be based around third world countries, the Bahamas, Puerto Rico, and the Caymans.
I can't imagine how crazy that program's going to be. By the way, on the way out, Stud, David Carmichael, who had the question about did you ever tag with Andre, or Robert Collier from Santa Rosa, California, the question about how many matches did you work with Andre the Giant, which of those fellers is going to win this week's autograph 8x10 from the Stud?
I think we're going to do it with the tag match with the gentleman, David Carmichael.
Mm-hmm. At a beautiful Johnson City, the Tri-Cities.
That'll be the gentleman.
Stud, absolutely incredible. Another hour spent with you. Any other thoughts on the way out? And thank you again for your time.
Just humbled. You know, I don't know if I've used that word in a while. I'm humbled by by the thousands and thousands of people worldwide that dig what I do, then they make it so plain to me by these compliments that just keep coming. All the social medias, maybe social media I should mention real quickly.
Let's do that.
Facebook, I'm going to be available at Ron Fuller Welch, but I'm mostly available now. That's a smaller site. It's packed. But a bigger site now is Ron Fuller Tennessee Stud. That's spelled out T-E-N-N-E-S-S-E. Tennessee spelled out long ways. Ron Fuller, Tennessee Stud. Just like me there, and you're on board. Those sites are just, they're booming. There's a lot of people there. Instagram and Twitter, Ron Fuller Welch. It's simple to reach me there. There's my website, obviously, is Tennessee Stud, tnstud.com. You can go to the website. Everything's on there. All the gallery is just getting, it's just blooming and blossoming all the time. In fact, this episode here, I'm going to have a picture of me blocking a guy's shot from high school, 1966. So, you know, there's all kinds of different things on that gallery now that fans, if you're a fan of wrestling, you need to go there and look at some of these pictures. And as these stories grow, and every time there's an episode, a new studcast, I'm adding new photo on the gallery. That's a phenomenal place to spend a few minutes if you're a wrestling fan. You're going to be intrigued, I believe, by what you see there. And other than that, just great. It's an honor and a pleasure. I love being a part of it. I just hope that people will catch that Super Stud cast, get also that rest of the Andre story. And thank you so much, all of you, for listening out there and for being a fan. And I hope they understand and feel, Tony, about how hard we are working for them. We probably do more now than any wrestling podcasters in the world so far as content for our fans. So just really pleased, and thank you very much to all the fans.
The great Ron Fuller has spoken for this week. I want to remind you, if you haven't heard, go to Ron Fuller's website and check out tnstud.com. You'll get more information there on the Super Stud cast involving Andre the Giant. You're going to want to do that, trust me. Also, don't get left out later on in the month. That special compendium with the Andre the Giant Super Stud cast will be available as well. But go to tnstud.com because you get the 1 hour question and answer as well as part of that special package. In the meantime, my name is Tony Basilio. I can be found at tonybasilio.com. Also, do a daily radio show in Knoxville and special features as well and all kinds of crazy stuff as it moves me. Things like this with the Tennessee Studs. So I've got my hands in several things, and I appreciate the Stud allowing me to be here, and I appreciate you, the living listener, spreading the word for us here in Studcast Nation. Until then, for everyone that had part in this, including the great David Summers, for the Tennessee Stud, this is Tony Basilio wishing you a great week. Let's come back and do this one more time, shall we?
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains. This Studcast is distributed by Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For inquiries about vocal work, send an email to davidsummersproductions@gmail.com.